Good morning. Welcome to the Schreiber Space Power Series. I'm Charles Galbraith, Senior Resident Fellow at the Mitchell Institute's Space Power Advantage Center of Excellence. Today, it's my pleasure to host Lieutenant General Phil Gurant, the Commander of Space Systems Command. He leads over 15,000 military, civilian, and contractor personnel, delivering cutting-edge space capabilities to the warfighter. Maintaining our edge in space is, through the systems that SSC delivers is critical to maintaining our advantage in space, deterring aggression, and prevailing in any future conflict. SSC serves as one of the Space Force's three acquisition organizations and has a long history going back to General Schriever and the Western Development Division. In fact, this July marks the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Western Development Division and the birth of military space. With that, General Gurant, welcome to the Schriever Space Power Series.
Thanks, Charles. It's a privilege to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Right. Before we dive into questions, let me give you an opportunity to make any opening comments.
Well, thanks to you, the Mitchell Institute, AFA, and the audience for joining us today. It's always important to talk about the incredible capabilities that SSC and the Space Force provides, both for the Joint Force and the world. So looking forward to the conversation.
All right, great. Let's dive in with some initial questions about culture, right? SSC and SMC before that has had a long history of delivering exceptional capabilities. But now there's a much greater sense of urgency, a need to deliver capabilities on a rapid pace. So there's cultural and organizational changes afoot. Would you mind talking a little bit about some of the organizational and cultural changes that are under your command at SSC?
Sure. And you mentioned our roots all the way back to the Western Development Division. In a sense, a little bit of a return to the roots, that sense of urgency, the culture. One of the things that I can influence as the commander with organized, train, and equip responsibilities is where we put our resources, both prioritizing programs, but perhaps more importantly, where we put our people. So we're focused on completing the work that General Guetlein started with the stand-up of SSC as a field command, the S-staff structure, pushing resources into the programs, looking at what I would call monolithic legacy SPOs, getting more to a smaller responsive SPO, and staffing up new programs. Colonel Corey Klopstein is the PEO for Operations Test and Training Infrastructure. He has very few people to manage his programs, so we have got to reallocate and reprioritize where we're putting our talent to get after these emerging programs. You know, the Space Force doubled its budget in 3 years. Most of that money is coming to the acquisition organizations that you mentioned. So we've got to be able to get after that and execute those funds effectively and deliver warfighting capability.
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely all about the people and the talent that you can harness there. So are you confident that you have the right uniform talent with the right skills and background to execute this critical mission?
I am, and I'd like to add that, you know, not just the uniform, but the civilian talent as well. We have a huge civilian workforce. We just have to put them on the right programs and then continue to advance their development. You mentioned the culture, you know, changing the way we deliver acquisition training, making it space focused, giving experiential opportunities, giving them a breadth of opportunities across a variety of programs, whether it's a very traditional large constellation, or it's a small constellation, or it's a responsive launch capability, or it's a national security space lift capability, making sure that they move around and get all of those different experiences and get to all of our different geographic locations. SSC has locations around the globe, over 29 different places. So it's a new look at development and culture with a warfighter focus as we field capability and support Space Force generation, so that when General Miller presents forces to Space Force Space or the service components, that they're equipped and have the capability and they're trained and know how to operate.
Yeah. So on that culture piece, and you talked about delivering warfighting capabilities, one of the initiatives coming out of the Space Force is the Officer Training Course, a program to sort of give all Guardians who are newly commissioned a basic foundation of either space operations, intelligence, or cyber expertise before going off into their own follow-on assignments. It's very similar to what we used to have when it was the Air Force of OPEX, but this is going to be for everybody. So what sort of impact is that going to have on the talent management at SSC?
The biggest thing I'd like to say about OTC is it's going to ground every officer guardian in what this service provides. Every guardian will be an operator. They're going to learn their trade. To your point about the OPEX, they're going to be better informed, better understand the mission, better understand the requirements. They're going to come back into acquisition and understand what the warfighter needs and be able to apply those lessons learned. At the OTC course, they'll get exposed to acquisition. There'll be a familiarization component of that class. but they'll come to SSC to get their basic practitioner training and become a qualified to become a material leader or a senior material leader. But it's that grounding and that common understanding and the networking and developing relationships that will last their entire career. And we're looking down the road at opportunities for existing acquisition guardians to be able to possibly take the course or something that a civilian could do so that over time we have all the same experience and understanding.
Yeah, that's great. I've been a long-term advocate of the integration between operations and acquisition, especially for space. Along those lines, the Space Force recently established the Integrated Mission Deltas. They've been in existence now for about 9 months, I want to say, with two lead efforts, one for PNT and one for Space EW. So how are those efforts going and what are the plans for the future?
The IMDs have done really well. We've learned a lot of information. Fundamentally, IMDs are about readiness. For the first time, we have a single mission commander in charge of the four components: people, training, equipment, and sustainment. Traditionally, the sustainment and parts of the equipment were covered under the acquisition organization, and the people in the training were covered under the operational. In these IMDs, the commander is either an acquirer or an operator, and the deputy is the other. So you have a team effort. It's important to note that the acquisition authorities still flow through the program manager to the PEO to the service acquisition executive, Mr. Calvelli. That does not change in an IMD, but we have tighter cohesion in weapon system sustainment and the ability to execute rapidly to field upgrades and address urgent discrepancies in those capabilities. We're pretty pleased with it. We have each IMD has a counterpart systems delta that is in acquisition in SSC. Think of it a more traditional acquisition program, very early in its development, not ready to transition into operations. But having that tight relationship gives you even closer alignment with the operators for ConOps, for requirements, for a user interface. We are expanding the concept. This summer, we're doing the mission analysis to expand on the missile warning mission area, as well as the space domain awareness.
Awesome. That's exciting.
It is.
Yeah, so one more personnel question. So recently, in fact, just last month, you had two SSC Guardians lieutenants complete some training with the Army, and they earned their Stetsons and their Silver Spurs with the Armored Cavalry. So why was this, so important for them? And then what does it really mean for SSC and the Guardians that you have in terms of integrating Guardians into joint exercises and operations?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I haven't had a chance to chat with the two gentlemen, but obviously congratulations to them. I would offer if that represents two parts of the Guardian ideal, our core values. And I would say the commitment and connection. Obviously, the commitment to earn their Stetson and Spurs. I went to Army War College. I know that's not an easy task.
Right.
I wouldn't even think I'd want to try, but it'd be fun to be there to watch them. And then the connection to the joint force, to the community. It really represents this idea that Guardians serve everyone. We serve the global economy. We serve the joint force. We also serve Space Force when we're developing capabilities for space superiority to support blue kill chains and defeat red kill chains. SSC does quite a bit. We deploy acquisition guardians in support of exercises and war games. It provides subject matter expertise on weapon systems, but it's also a fantastic learning opportunity that traditionally acquisition officers and civilians didn't have before we took on this effort.
That's great. And so space is truly a joint sort of service where you're providing support and capabilities to the Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Air Force, as well as you said, industry and everybody in the U.S. and around the world, frankly.
Right.
That's exciting. So I was visiting the SSC webpage this morning, and you've got a countdown clock, counting down 589 days now until 2026. That really, I think, establishes a sense of urgency for what it is you're trying to deliver in terms of resilience and being ready for the fight just around the corner. Can you talk a little bit about what your objectives are in the near term and what you're trying to achieve by establishing that countdown clock and that sense of urgency for 2026?
That countdown clock got its roots in 2021 when Admiral Davidson left INDOPACOM and relieved command to Admiral Aquilino. At the time, he said, we've got 5 years. So that's where 2026 comes from. You've heard senior leaders talk about a date, whether it's 27 or 26. For the purpose of the countdown clock, we chose 26. Within days of taking command, we got together in Colorado Springs with the other field comm commanders, Tim Shaba from Starcom and Rock Miller from Spock, and all of our subject matter experts. And we said, look, we only have, at the time, it was about 22 months before 2026 is here, which isn't a lot of time. And we know that that's not enough time to POM for new capability. That's not a time to start a new development effort. So really, if we go to crisis or conflict, to quote Secretary Rumsfeld, we're going to go to war with the army we have. So we need to make sure that that kit that we have and we know we'll have, we need to make sure that we're able to use it and fully execute the kill chains. So over the course of the spring, we've been doing a series of tabletop exercises to identify known gaps that we can go after to close those kill chains. Right now, we're getting into early summer. The acquisition community is meeting with industry to find out what's a realistic capability that we can fix. Later this summer, we'll go to General Saltzman with a one-to-end list with proposals of we need to reprioritize that list of things. We might need to go after some new funding, or we need to possibly stop doing a few things so that we can put that funding towards these efforts. We're at 19 months already. We still have to develop, field, test, train, and then force present. We can't just throw it over the transom. These operators have got to have time to develop tactics, techniques, and procedures. I call this a call to action when I talk to SSC about this. But the idea is a big sense of urgency. The adversary isn't stopping. We're seeing behavior from Russia. You've heard about things Russia's doing in the press. We're seeing adversarial behavior from China. We need to be prepared, and we need to make sure that the kit we have, we can use.
Awesome. So I mentioned at the beginning that SSC is one of three acquisition organizations within Space Force, along with the Space Rapid Capabilities Office and Space Development Agency. But what is unique about SSC among those three? I hear the term fully burdened capability used quite a bit. Could you explain to our audience what that means as a fully burdened capability and why that distinction is so important?
It really gets to the dot mil PF process. We want to make sure that when we deliver a weapon system, it's not just the weapon system. We're delivering it to a location that has a facility that can house operators who have been trained on the capability and are able to force present it. So it's a mind shift change to make sure that anytime we deliver something, it's fully burdened to meet all of the, its reliability, its availability, its maintainability. The operators have the trainers necessary, and not just basic training, but advanced skills training against a thinking adversary. We want to make sure that all of the pieces of a system are there. And we need to start this work early. And we've started this a couple of years ago when we develop our program and into the POM and into the president's budget, that all of those are accounted for as well. So it's fully budgeted, it's fully resourced, and the operators are ready to take the equipment. The ground system is delivered, to Mr. Calvelli's tenets of acquisition. You've got the ground system needs to come first. So that's the mind shift change, that we're not just delivering a kit and tossing it over the fence. It's an integrated team making sure that when it's delivered, everything you need to operate it is available.
Well, that really goes back to the integrated Mission Delta kind of concept, as well as making sure that the acquisition community and the operations community are closely linked and seamlessly transitioning technology to the warfighter. That's great. But at that same time, we also need to make sure that we're able to rapidly transition technologies, prototypes, ops demonstrations, to fully develop capabilities. When I was in uniform, we did a lot of demonstrations and prototypes. Not all of them made it across that sort of valley of death that we hear so much about. So what is SSC doing to ensure that there is this rapid transition of capabilities?
That's an important point to recognize. And you mentioned some of our acquisition partners. Some of their systems will transition to SSC for production and sustainment. But we need to closely align those prototypes and demonstrations to an operational need, not just for their own sake. That's the first piece. And we'll do a little bit of that work with the Futures Command. The other part is having rapid organizations that have that culture and mindset themselves. The Rapid Reaction Branch in Colorado Springs is known for being able to do that. Space Safari, we have has employees in it who came from Big Safari, from the Air Force's Big Safari. So it's the mindset of rapidly delivering capability. Secretary Kendall is always asking, how do you operationalize these things? He's always asking tactically responsive space, how do you operationalize that? So it's the CONOPS development. It's the working with the operators. It's working with industry to make sure that we do have a pathway from prototypes and demonstrations. We'll always have the case where we might have a game-changing capability that we have to present to the warfighter without all of those abilities or without an immediate pathway. But that's going to be important enough that we're going to take that operational risk to do something quickly. But foundationally, having the culture and the mindset of every prototype and demonstration has a transition to operations, and the team is working closely with operators so that they can receive that capability.
Great. So not all of the capabilities that the Space Force needs to have come from an acquisition organization per se. I mean, commercial has a lot of great capabilities out there already. And of course, the DoD and the Space Force both released their strategies for leveraging commercial space capabilities earlier this year. But SSC actually established the Commercial Space Office, or COMSO, last year. So can you talk a little bit about the progress being made by that office and how comfortable you are with the integration of commercial capabilities?
Yeah, we're really excited about COMSO. Colonel Rich Nisley is the senior material leader there, and he's doing a fantastic job leading that organization. He's going to be moving this summer to the National Capital Region to be closer to a lot of industry and closer to a lot of the Department of Defense stakeholders. A lot of people don't realize all the different parts of COMSO. The first is the front door, and that's the entryway for emerging industry partners, academic partners, to get their foot in the door, so to speak, right, and make connections. A lot of times, they don't know who to talk to. That front door organization is the means to do that. You mentioned on our website, there's a link to it, and on the back of my business card is a QR code that will take you to the front door. So anytime I meet someone, they're getting a business card. We've had 150 engagements with the front door alone with non-traditional industry partners.
That's awesome.
SpaceWorks is another part of COMSO. It partnership to AFWERX. SpaceWorks has awarded over 160 efforts valued over a $250 million.
Wow.
To get after innovative ideas, again, non-traditional companies to get after those capabilities. Then we have the very traditional commercial satellite communications office run by Claire up at Fort Meade. They're executing over $3.5 billion in 70 contracts, providing DoD commercial satellite communications to users. And then we have the Space Domain Awareness Marketplace, feeding activities like the JCO, where companies can bring their capabilities, and we present that data to allies, not just the U.S. warfighters. And then finally, the new CASR, the Commercial Augmentation Space Reserve concept.
Right.
So COMSO is become really big. I like to tease Rich, and I tell him my goal is to put him out of a job, such that we change the culture at SSC. So commercial is the first instinct for a PEO for an act strategy, not an afterthought. We'll always have the front door.
Right.
We'll always have SpaceWorks. But if I can get these commercial things like the SDA marketplace and the commercial SATCOM office baked into the PEO's thinking and budget, then I think we've been a success.
Awesome. And that goes back to one of the mantras I've heard from SSC in the past, which is, leverage what we have, buy what we can, and only build what we must. So to your point of potentially putting him out of business, that building that into the launch to the
right. And,
mindset.
And General Guetlein started that when he took command of SSC, and we're absolutely continuing that along with the culture of understanding the threat.
Yeah, awesome. So you mentioned some non-traditionals, and I know one of the mechanisms that SSC has used in the past for non-traditionals was the Space Enterprise Consortium. At some point, we had over 400 traditional and non-traditional companies as part of this consortium to help let contracts using other transition authorizations. Do you mind talking to the audience a little bit about what SPEC-OTA is and what its progress is?
Absolutely. SPEC is a game changer. It's about 7 years old. To your point, we now have over 600 SPEC consortium members, and over 85% of those are, again, non-traditionals. So it gives them access to us. We've awarded 123 contracts valued at over $3.5 billion. But what's exciting is there's tremendous period of performance and ceiling left to go. There are billions of dollars in available ceiling that the government can use to award these OTAs to these companies, and very quickly, and with a lot of new authorities that let us get after new ideas quickly.
That's great. So shifting a little bit to the industrial base, as organizations like at Space Development Agency proliferate, in low Earth orbit with small satellites, it seems to be putting a demand signal on the supply chain. Are you seeing any issues from the SSC perspective regarding some supply chain issues? And what are you doing to address that?
We are seeing some, but nothing that's critical or concerning. And we feel like we've made the turn coming out of COVID too. We certainly had a lot of supply chain issues during COVID, but nothing that's going to stop our mission or impact providers to the point that we're really worried about capability delivery. We do take supply chain very seriously at SSC. I mentioned the front door organization. Two of the purposes they serve is they'll also screen a company for foreign influence. Mm-hmm. They'll also screen a company for financial viability. But in addition to that, we're also interested in the pedigree of the parts, very much a heritage from our launch heritage, where we're going to look and screen parts. So we have a supply chain management organization, a team that it's under our CIO office, but right now they've screened over 2,800 vendors and parts, supporting four particular programs. And then we've done 150 vendor assessments, and we've also screened 50 components for 8 programs. So it's a very important part of our mission to make sure that we're not getting counterfeit parts, that we're not getting foreign influence, that the parts are reliable. So we will continue doing that. And we find it helps the industry base. We work with partners like the Aerospace Corporation to identify issues and mitigations.
Great, thank you. So one of the great successes last year was a project called Victus Nox, and you demonstrated the ability to take a satellite from warehouse, move it out to Vandenberg to launch it and have it operational on orbit within less than a week. And now you're following that up with a program called Victus Haze. Can you talk a little bit about that program and then the overall construct of what seems to be a Victus series of activities? What are the objectives there?
Sure. And I'll take the second one first. So Victus is, to your point, that is our series of continually demonstrating what is not just a capability, but a culture, this idea of going fast. So you'll see a Victus mission every year, and it'll have a different name. Victus Haze, which will launch sometime in 2025. We're not going to tell the providers when. Will be a space domain awareness mission. This time we're going to have multiple space vehicle providers, as well as payload providers and a launch provider. And it will be the same model. You know, they'll be put on contract. They'll go on hot standby. They'll get activated. They'll be on alert. They'll do on orbit checkout and into operations. You know, Victus Nox, I mentioned the culture. We took an FAA approval that took 10 days and got it down to 48 hours.
Wow.
You know, we turned on the launch window, and the goal was 24 hours. We launched in 27 only because of the orbit we were going to, and physics still gets a vote.
Sure.
So the idea is agility and speed. It gets back to that urgency. I mentioned the adversaries are continuing to exhibit poor behavior. Victus gives us an opportunity to have a rapid response. And to show resolve and the commitment to the world that, you know, we can address those types of threats. So sometime in 25, you'll see a call up, you'll see a mission turn on, and we'll execute. Now, it's important to realize we're breaking new ground here. You know, it's not going to have the same mission assurance that a national security asset might on an SSL launch.
Right.
So there's always a risk, but it's a risk we're willing to take, because we learn tremendous amounts of information and change the culture while we're doing it.
Well, that's fundamentally it. The culture of the legacy capabilities was so risk averse that drove up costs, drove up timelines. But now we're seeing the threat advance at such a pace that we have to develop capabilities at a much more rapid pace. And that includes taking some additional risks. So it's great to see that culture is being embedded into some of the programs at SSC. It's awesome. So launch. Nothing gets to space without getting launched, you know, and whether that's Victus Haze or Victus Nox or just an NSSL. The pace of launch has really picked up in the past couple of years, largely thanks to SpaceX and Starlink satellites. But in 2024, we're looking at over 100 launches just out of the Eastern Range. What is SSC doing to make sure that the range is modern and capable of handling that additional stress from a hardware perspective and an IT perspective?
So 174 launches this year, 116 of them at the Cape. So a huge increase. I remember when I was first in launch in 2011, and we were worried about a dozen NSSL launches.
Yeah.
Now, to your point, these include a lot of commercial launches, but a huge increase in Vandenberg as well. The OMB gave us $1.3 billion in the recent budget to get after that infrastructure. It's going to be over 130 projects managed in partnership with IMSC, with the Civil Engineering Center, and the Army Corps of Engineers over the FYDP, basically, to get after that. Now, I'll say that a lot of that is built up technical debt. That's not improving capacity. That's getting after known capacity problems.
Mm.
So to your point, we've got to figure out new things that we can do to keep up with that. Looking at digitizing the range. So you could, so that people on the East Coast could launch a rocket on the West Coast from the East Coast, as an example. The ranges have already become transparent to each other. So a West Coast workforce can augment an East Coast mission and vice versa.
Okay.
Looking at our processes, I mentioned mission assurance. We're in the midst of a broad area review, specifically looking at mission assurance to get after the increased capacity that you just mentioned and supporting the commercial mission. Congress gave us some new authorities to help us get additional funding from these commercial launch service providers. How do we take advantage of that? Because it's not just about fixing the technical debt of the existing infrastructure. It's about building out the infrastructure. Congress wants us, we just saw the marks for the 25. Congress wants us to look at additional spaceports.
Right.
You know, are they feasible? Can we support them? Are they, you know, do they make sense for the orbits and the missions that we're doing? So a lot of review of policy, a lot of review of processes, how we do mission assurance, where we need to increase the infrastructure. The launch deltas are manned at a 2017 manning rate and a 2017 launch assessment.
Wow.
We're launching a lot more missions 7 years later, yet we're still manned as if we were doing dozens, not hundreds.
Wow. And so if I could dig in a little bit more on that, because that is really fascinating that we're a little behind the power curve on terms of launch. But what you said is you're investing to recover from tech debt, as opposed to thinking about what type of launch capabilities we're going to need in 2030. You're just trying to catch up.
Yeah, and let me maybe correct myself. We need to do both, and we are doing both.
Okay.
Yeah, we are absolutely getting after the tech debt that we have, but we're fundamentally looking at, you know, how do we prepare for what will be phase four of NSSL? Yeah, I want to be clear with the audience that it's not that we're not looking forward. We have a lot of work to do today, and then fundamentally looking at how we can keep up in the future.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. So a lot of attention has been placed on small satellites lately. And my next paper, in fact, is about small satellites. So I think there's a lot of capability there. But there's still a need for some of those exquisite capabilities. Evolved Strategic SATCOM, for example, was announced earlier this year that it's going to be a cost-plus program, as opposed to Honorable Cavelli's really hard push towards fixed price. So why was that distinction for ESS so important to be a cost plus? And are there other areas that you see require a different sort of mindset for programs at SSC?
Yeah, I'll be very careful not to speak for Mr. Calvelli, but I'll give you my perspective on that situation. I would say that was a recognition of the risk and the strategic importance of that particular mission. We've talked about Mr. Calvelli's tenants with a preference for fixed price development. That decision to go to cost plus was the result of a conversation between Mr. Calvelli, the program executive officer, the program manager, and industry, and a recognition that the initial development on such a critical mission was more risk than FFP could bear. And it's only for the first four satellites. The follow-on production will absolutely be a fixed price effort.
That's good to know. So those exquisite exquisite satellites that we used to talk about, General Hyten called them juicy targets. How are you going to make sure that ESS doesn't become another juicy target?
So without going into details, I can offer that these exquisite and very strategic assets do have resilient capabilities included. One thing that we've done that's very novel, and Colonel A.J. Ashby, who's a submaterial leader for ESS, is asking industry, you tell us what, you know, separate from the requirements, what opportunities do you as a vendor have to provide additional resiliency? So we're actually asking industry to propose ideas to us. And we think we're going to get some new ideas that we hadn't thought of, or perhaps we weren't sure could fit in the affordability caps on these programs. And we expect to get different ideas from the different vendors. And that will be part of the source selection is what are these options that add additional resiliency? And that'll be part of the RFP.
Resiliency and protection. And so including that as part of the proposal.
That's right. Whether it's self-protection, the ability to maneuver without regret.
Okay. Great. Earlier this year at the Warfighter Symposium, it was announced that the Space Force is establishing a Space Futures Command to look 20 or 30 years into the future. And in the audience, I thought back to, well, when I was a captain, I was at SMC Developmental Planning Directorate, where we looked 20 or 30 years in the future. And I'm like, okay, so everything old is new again.
That's right.
But what is the relationship between this new field command going to be, where it's looking at future capabilities, and SSC?
This new field command, and the intent is to be active provisionally by August, will be another very geographically diverse command. There'll be a headquarters component, the futures part of that Colonel Carl Baltofsen does under General Bratton. It'll be commanded by a general officer. There'll be three centers, and I like to think of them in terms of pillars, but they're centers. One on concepts and technologies, that's led by Colonel Pete Mastro. The Dell 10 from Starcom will lead the Wargaming and Exercise Center. And then the Space Warfighting Analysis Center that we all know of, the SWAC, will continue its traditional role. And the idea is they will build that future force that then goes into the programmed force, which ultimately we hope becomes a fielded force. Donald Saltzman likes to talk about risk of mission being the difference between those three forces, the force design that we want, the force design that's budgeted, and the force design that we have. So this Futures Command is going to, from a dot mil PF look, so back to your previous question, going to look across the capabilities that are emerging, the Valley of Death, some of those prototypes and demonstration activities that you mentioned, to get those fielded. And to your point, it's the old XPXR view of the world. So all of the field commands are going to have a role to play, whether it's the wargaming or that's the mission area teams from SPOC, or in our case, the S&T and some of the initial engineering and architecture work that our integration office does. They will all be working with or for Space Futures Command. Those decisions haven't been made yet, but we might actually move people from SSC into Futures. Now, they'll still stay in Los Angeles, so they're connected to our organization. Okay. We anticipate an academic tie. We expect a NASA tie, an innovation tie. So the idea is to bring all of these different relevant stakeholders into a single command focused on building that future from a .mil PF and getting after some of these game-changing capabilities.
Awesome. I look forward to seeing the rollout of that in August and the great projects that are going to come out of there. But again, it's all back to making sure that there is an operational pull that goes along with that tech push and the seamless transition of capabilities to deliver rapidly to the warfighter.
That's absolutely right.
Awesome. Well, I am out of my questions. So are you ready to open it up for the audience?
Let's do it.
Take some open Q&A. All right. So with that, we'll open it up to the audience for Q&A. By now, you know the drill. Aiden will call on you. Make sure you unmute your mic. Please state your name and affiliation before asking your question. You can also submit your questions in writing via the Q&A function. So with that, who do we have first, Aiden?
First, we have Greg Hadley from Air and Space Forces Magazine.
Hi, General Grant. Thanks for doing this. My question was about the resilient missile warning, missile tracking constellation for medium Earth orbit. Could you give me an update on how that program is progressing and what you see as kind of the future for it and how you guys are working with SDA to kind of make sure that connects with their constellation in LEO?
Yeah, let me brag on the team a little bit. It's led by Colonel Heather Bogstie, and it's in Colonel Rob Davis's portfolio. You mentioned the partnership with SDA. We actually have a combined program office. It's SSC, SDA, and the Missile Defense Agency, working with Walt Chai's folks that do the space sensor layer. You mentioned it is a hybrid architecture. We have the traditional capabilities, next generation capabilities, the SBIRS-like capabilities. We have the medium Earth orbit layer, which will be a broad architectural constellation, and then working with SDA and MDA on the proliferated LEO layer. So it's going very well. It's a fantastic partnership. We couldn't do it by ourselves. The department recognizes that. It's reflected in the budgets across that entire mission area. If I'm not mistaken, we just released an RFP on EPIC 2, or we're getting ready to release it, which is specific to the MEO layer.
So you're not only getting some additional resilience by going through the different orbital altitudes, but you're also getting different capability sets as well.
That's right.
Okay, great. And how do they all seamlessly stitch together? That's the proof in the pudding.
That's right. So some of that will integrate into the existing OPIR architecture already. In the future, new capabilities will also integrate into that architecture. Dr. Tornier and the SDA has a lot of work with his warfighter architecture, delivering that capability as well. It's an unusual approach. It's a novel approach of delivering data, in a sense, as opposed to delivering a satellite, which provides that capability.
Right.
So we have diversity in architecture, we have diversity in CONOPS, we have diversity in capability, all of it intended to inform the warfighter, and in some cases, to present data directly to a weapon system to prosecute a missile threat.
Awesome. And making sure that the warfighter gets that in a timely fashion so that they can take the appropriate action.
Exactly.
Wow, great. Aidan, who's second on deck?
Next, we have a question from Stephen Clark.
Hey, Janelle, can you hear me?
Yes, Stephen, go ahead.
Great. Yeah, my question, I think, it involves, refueling in orbit. The Space Force has talked about maneuver without regret and dynamic space operations a lot over the last year or two. However, some recent comments suggest there, some of the leadership may not be sold on that. There may be another way to achieve that goal of dynamic space operations. Can you talk about some of the studies that are underway within the Space Force or Space Systems Command in particular on the utility of refueling and whether there may be another way through proliferation or another way to achieve that goal of dynamic space operations? Thanks.
Sure. The next generation of satellites, that will be a requirement. So it's what we're really talking about is the near term to the next, say, 10 to 15 years of how do we get after that, primarily for systems that are already on orbit. We have an organization at Patrick Air Force, Space Force Base, led by Colonel Joyce Bolson, looking at space mobility and logistics. She's part of the Assured Access to Space team under Brigadier General Panzerhagen. And she does have funding in the appropriation, and we look to continue that get after novel ideas and to do some demonstrations and prototypes. To your question about recent senior leader comments, I think the jury is still out. We do need to do some more analysis. Is it cost effective? Chuck Beams just did an op-ed recently where he suggested it would be cheaper to just proliferate with smaller small sats. Now, Charles's question about the more strategic missions, kind of begs the question that we can't proliferate those. So how do we get after that? So I think there is ongoing analysis to see, does it make sense? One point I like to make when people are pitching ideas to me is you still have to get the gas tank to space. And launching a big satellite with gas, so to speak, up to geo is not a trivial matter. That's a high energy launch and it's not inexpensive. So a lot of times someone might say, well, I can do it for you for X millions of dollars. And then my question is, well, does that include the ride? And they're like, oh. So the short answer is ongoing analysis. We think it's an important capability. We think it's a near-term issue more than a long-term issue, because in the longer term, the constellations will incorporate that into their capabilities.
So it kind of makes me think a little bit about electric cars, right? And there was some hesitancy for people to buy electric cars because how far do I have to go before I get to a refueling station? I mean, because they still have to be charged. But what you're saying is that architecture is going to be built into whatever is the next generation of capabilities, just de facto. And you're just going to leverage that as a baseline level of capability going forward. Is that about right?
We'll see what the force design looks like, but that's exactly what the Futures Command would look at.
Okay.
And it's not going to be for every single satellite. It doesn't make sense. It's certain mission areas.
Right. No, that I understand completely. Yeah. It just depends on the mission area. But it also, I think about Air Power as well, Mitchell Institute, Air and Space Power. And one of the things that we have on the Air Power side is air-to-air refueling, right? And that's a routine military mission. We don't do that on the commercial side. I haven't flown from Dulles to LA and had to be refueled at mid-flight. So I'm wondering if there's some inherent military aspects. And again, maybe that's Futures Command's role to look at.
Right. I think there is. And there is absolute value. I don't want the audience to think that I don't believe there's value. There is. But we're budget constrained and we have budget priorities. So we need to make sure that we're addressing those.
Right.
And maybe it's a value trade that it is in the long run, particularly when you consider launch, cheaper to put up another satellite.
Okay. No, thanks for that insight. Aidan, who's next?
We have a written-in question from Shelley Mesk of Inside Defense. She asks, has SSC been influenced at all by the work of SDA?
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Tournier and his team have fundamentally changed acquisition. They have leveraged the commercial force. They've leveraged relationships with the warfighter, and they've really leveraged other authorities. So we've learned a lot of lessons from them. I mentioned the partnership in missile warning, where it's a combined program office, and we are their launch provider. So we are constantly meeting. So there's an informal group. It's of acquisition leaders. We all get together every other week, and then we have the Program Integration Council, which is anybody that spends Space Force dollars on space-related programs. We get together, so we're constantly leveraging lessons learned and relationships and building on it. But at the same time, we're trying not to duplicate efforts. You know, space RCO by statute is JSIDS exempt. You know, Dr. Tournier has his authorities from his organization, SSC, a more traditional organization, but a legacy of delivering large constellations right. of very effective capability. So without getting on each other's toes, leveraging lessons learned and collaborating where it makes sense.
So, you know, we talked about fully burdened capabilities earlier. Is there some part of SSC that looks at what SDA or Space RCO is fielding and making sure that there is that sustainment tail associated with it? Or do those organizations do that as well?
So SDA will do its sustainment, but all of the Space RCO programs transition to SSC for production and sustainment. So there's a direct connection for every Space RCO program to an SSC program office that's already preparing for that. To use an old analogy, very much like in the Air Force with the logistics centers, where there'll be a depot that has a really close relationship with a program office. And then the Space Systems Integration Office, led by Dr. Claire Leon, looks across all of SSC and basically anybody who spends Space Force budget authority on a system, whether it's SDA or Space RCO or AFRL or NRO or MDA or DIU. There's many, many organizations. So they're looking across the entire enterprise from an integration and architecture perspective to make sure that all of this capability works together, and that we're effectively getting after the kill chain without duplicating effort. So there's that engineering piece, mm-hmm. and working very closely with Colonel Eric Felt in SQA, and then there's the actual sustainment piece. And then we talked about the IMDs, and the next logical conclusion is now that sustainment of the fielded capability is happening in the operational element. So it's the entire life cycle of a capability being looked at across all of those.
Awesome. Aiden, who's next?
Sort of related to duplicating effort, we have a question from Harold Peters. He asks, a lot of U.S. allies have a highly advanced space sectors themselves. Is SSC looking to partner and leverage any of this foreign allied expertise? And related to that, have partnerships like AUKUS helped facilitate this sort of partnership at all?
Absolutely. So Ms. Deanna Riles leads our international organization at SSC. She has hundreds of engagements. I'm meeting next week with General Adam from France. It's a constant and ongoing engagement. She was just in Australia. We work, so there's lots of reasons to partner. If you can have entanglement with a foreign or commercial capability, that complicates the calculus for the adversary. If you can spend their money, it gives us access. There's a lot of places that we want to be in the world that, you know, our other countries' territories, so we can get access to it. So it's constant. There'll be an international component of the Futures Command to look at where can we leverage foreign capabilities. The gentleman asked about AUKUS. DARC, so the Deep Space Advanced Radar capability, is a classic example. It's an official AUKUS program. We've started construction on the first site in Australia, and that construction is going very well. We'll have a second location in the UK. So leveraging those relationships and leveraging foreign investments and then sharing that data, that's perhaps the most important part, is all this data is going to be releasable to our partners and allies, and it's going to contribute to our space domain awareness and help with where we need to prosecute kill chains.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, U.S. Space Command, not to be confused with the Space Force, but U.S. Space Command has several bilateral agreements with nations to share domain awareness information, for example. And through Claire's efforts and programs like DARC, you're actually establishing those same sorts of of agreements and partnerships in place.
Yeah. That's right. Another example is JCO that Ms. Barb Gulf in SSC helps work with Space Command, as well as our allies and partners. We're setting up a situation where we'll have a global 24/7 watch center, because two of the three watch centers will be in other parts of the world, one in Europe, one in Asia. And that will be providing commercially available, unclassified space domain awareness data to our allies and partners.
So you talked about entanglement. One of the strengths of the United States is we never go into a conflict by ourselves, at least not in recent history. We always have our allies and partners, and they're an incredible teaming opportunity to overall make our effectiveness even better than we could have been before. So it's great to see that that's happening in space as well. You also talked about the need for different geographies in Australia and UK. I mean, we are surrounded by space. It is a 360 sort of environment that we have to manage. Are there other areas where you're looking at fielding capabilities that rely on those sorts of geographic dispersion around the globe?
Absolutely. We have a tremendous partnership with South Command, Southern Command, and looking at opportunities in Southern South America. A lot of countries are very interested to help build out the SOCI network. And space domain awareness is a relatively inexpensive way to enter into this community of partnerships. A ground-based telescope, a ground-based antenna is pretty cheap to operate in the grand scheme of things. And allows a sovereign country to contribute and be a partner with us. So that's another example.
Great. Thank you. Aidan, back to you for the next question.
We have a question from Emily Davis. She asks, historically, a lot of the capabilities that SSC has created have been some of the most sensitive and secretive that the U.S. has made. As we transition to this era of more overt space competition, how is SSC balancing the need for secrecy with some of these systems, with also leveraging the power of partnerships that you just discussed and the deterrent value of actually disclosing capabilities that we have or are developing?
So this is a big cultural shift for us. And you've seen and read a lot recently, Deputy Secretary of Defense Hicks had started her SAP reform effort, and we're now in the processes of implementing that, where we're going to cut down significantly on the numbers of SAPs and how they're categorized. That will make it easier to talk amongst ourselves, even never mind with partners and allies. And then Dr. Plum, before he left service, had talked about some of the capabilities, primarily with our Operational Olympic Defender partners with U.S. Space Command, on some capabilities where we can get after space control with certain partners. So in some mission areas, we have declassified some of those programs, or at least made them available to our partners. And again, the advantage is the access. There are parts of the world that we would like to be able to present capability, and they offer the opportunity to do that. So you will see more conversation, maybe not completely unclassified, but okay. You're going to start to see more conversations with our partners on capabilities. And then General Saltzman always likes to emphasize the deterrence aspect of space. Missile warning is our contribution to strategic integrated deterrence. But ideally, we don't want to have to use some of these exquisite classified capabilities that the question that the person was asking about. So we need to be able to demonstrate before we get into crisis and conflict the ability to affect the adversary kill chain. And ideally, we're going to do that with reversible effects. So we need to be able to have that broad spectrum to be able to deter and allow diplomacy a chance to work.
So the efforts by the Department of Defense to lower classification restrictions, you still protect what we need to protect,
right,
but increasing the opportunity for others, as well as working with our partners to increase their understanding and familiarity. That's all great from a development perspective, but it also is critical from an exercising perspective, where I see a lot more Olympic Defender, you mentioned, a lot more of our allies and partners working with the Space Force on these exercises. And we talked about the Guardians who went and earned their Stetsons. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how the classification restructuring, this culture shift, is impacting our ability to integrate into exercises?
Yeah, probably the best example is the Schriever War Game, which is an annual space-based war game that we do. And we invite foreign partners to participate, and we do it at a classified level. And we can do it at different classified levels, so we can allow different partners to participate at the level that that they are approved for access for.
Right.
Another example is the combined space, the CSPO initiative has just expanded to include new countries, Italy and Japan, among others. So we're continuing to grow the family of countries that are provided access to our most important capabilities, and then including them in the exercising. It does us no good if they're not comfortable with the capability, that their governments aren't comfortable with the capability, that they're a part of the operation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So a big tent approach, which is great, but everybody contributing in the ways that they can. Right. Not everybody's going to be clear to everything, but that doesn't mean you're not part of the overall campaign.
Right.
Great. Aidan, what's next?
We have a question from William McGuffey. He asks, how has artificial intelligence capabilities influenced SSC's strategic posture?
Hi, Bill. Hope you're doing well. Thanks for the question. The entire department is exploring AI and ML, and there are some very visible capabilities. Secretary Kendall just flew on a Venom aircraft,
right,
as an example, which is developing tactics, techniques, and procedures for the collaborative combat aircraft program. That's on the Air Force side. On the Space Force side, we're exploring, how do we, probably the best example is we have the Unified Data Library, which is a vast collection of space-related data, primarily space domain awareness data. It's too much for the human to right, analyze and comprehend. So how do we use AI machine learning tools to learn patterns of behavior, norms of behavior, detect anomalous behavior, understand intent? That's an example. We have a lot of initiatives for visualization that are taking advantage of some of those technologies, mm-hmm, and how do we employ it? When I was at the Missile Defense Agency, there was a recognition that, that fight might become too complex for the human to operate. You could conceivably see the same situation in a fight in space, where there's so much happening that the human needs to be on the loop. They just can't be in the loop because of the timelines that we're talking about. We're going to need AI and machine learning to assist with developing courses of action and autonomous behavior to augment the human operators.
Yeah, especially as we consider the proliferation of small satellites and, constellations of hundreds or even thousands, we're not going to be able to have operators, tracking each one of those individually. And so AI is going to be absolutely essential, I think. And the pace at which conflict might occur would also drive that. So it's really interesting to hear. I think it's important to remind folks that there is a distinction between artificial intelligence, machine learning, and autonomy, and sometimes they feed each other. But we don't want people to get the impression that we're going to turn the reins over to the machine master, and Skynet's going to take over our space war of the future.
Right? That's right. That would never be our intent.
Right. Human.
It's human augmentation.
Human augmentation. Human on the loop. Human making the final decision, if needed. Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. Aidan, back to you for the next question.
We have a question from Pete Higgins. He says, Charles brings up a great point that the U.S. does not enter conflicts alone and that we increase our strengths through our allies and partners. Should we also be concerned that our adversaries might be doing the same thing? And are we prepared to take on multiple adversaries in space simultaneously?
So when the adversary applies an entanglement strategy as well, but the last time I checked, the ledger of allies with the United States and the allies of China and Russia, that is not an equal balance. But would you care to elaborate on that?
Sure. And that's what's so important about our engagements with our international partners, and not just the traditional Five Eyes partners, but all of our partners. I mentioned South America. That's a great example. We know that China is looking to expand its presence in South America. But if I have a partner country, and I can say, you know what, I can put a SOCI sensor in your country just as easily as China, we prefer that you partner with us.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, that's the decision that they make. So that's an example where we are expanding our who we partner with. And I mentioned the barrier to entry being much lower for space domain awareness for some of these right, non-traditional partners. That's a great area where we can do that and be their preferred partner instead of them partnering with Russia or China.
So is there kind of a no-compete clause in our relationships with these countries? That's we're exclusive, right?
It's probably not in my wheelhouse to answer. Okay. You know, the Department of State gets involved in a lot of those conversations as well. You know, we're just happy to partner with these countries and share our data with them and be able to leverage by putting an antenna or something in their place.
Awesome. Aidan, I think we have time for a couple more questions.
We have a writing question from Teresa Hitchens from Breaking the Fence. She asks, do you expect to create any more integrated mission deltas soon since you've been getting good results with the two initial prototypes?
Hi, thanks, Teresa. Thank you for the question and thanks for joining us on the call. In fact, General Miller and I owe General Guetlein an integrated progress review here in a couple of weeks. We're doing mission analysis on the two existing operational deltas are DEL-2 and DEL-4, space domain awareness and missile warning. And then the long-term intent is to, over the course of the next year and a half, is to finish out the rest of the mission areas. It is a pretty significant lift when you look at organizational change requests and some of the restructuring, and then making sure that we're not hurting anyone's career, you know, when we stand up these commands, or we're not making anyone lose their job. So it's a very deliberate process, and to make sure we pair the systems deltas appropriately as well. You know, in the next few months, you can look for missile warning and space domain awareness as two mission areas. And then in the future, satellite communications, for example, and then orbital warfare.
But the intent is for all mission areas to be in this integrated mission delta approach and all done personnel neutral. You're not going to require additional manpower to support these activities.
That's right. And we're not making people move. We're not making people PCS. Now, in time, 10 years down the road, maybe it makes sense to move some people around to better co-locate them. But near term, that's not the intent.
Okay, great. Thank you. Aidan, let's go to another one.
We have a question from Albert Gardner. He asks, you mentioned that you have a pending RFP for a resilient solution for the ESS program. Can you discuss any other pending RFPs where SSC is actually soliciting inputs for solutions from industry rather than just giving out requirements?
Sure. I mentioned this effort of trying to rapidly close the kill chain, what I call the call to action. We're working with industry partners and Aerospace Corporation to solicit ideas on that industry might have to be able to get after these gaps and seams that we're identifying with the war games and exercises. So that's another example where it's not a classic program. It doesn't have a classic requirement. It's a what can you do for us? And then there's I believe it's in June down in Raleigh, North Carolina. There's another reverse industry day where industry can come in and give us their ideas as well.
Okay. But is there a location, a website where you basically hang your request for proposals so people understand? And I know with the Space Enterprise Consortium, there was an opportunity for those now 600 partners to see what's available to them. Is something like that on a larger scale?
I mean, the best one is the SAM.gov, the very traditional government website. You know, the front door will provide access to data.
Great.
But I'll take that back as a, you know, perhaps something we might consider is a on the SSC website, a link to active solicitations.
Okay, excellent. Well, we're getting close to the end of time. Thank you, General Grant, for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking with you and getting some additional insight on where SSC is today and where they're headed in the future. And ladies and gentlemen, with that, we've come to the end of this Schriever Space Power Series session with General Grant. Again, my thanks to General Grant, as well as all of you for joining us today. And from all of us at MI Space, have a great Space Power Day.